is interesting on so many different levels. It's interesting just in terms of the details, in terms of what's involved. This is a year where the topic of Kinyan is very much a part of our limud, so we've referenced Mechiras Chametz a few times because of some of the intricacies of Kinyan. But Mechiras Chametz is also the topic of a lot of discussion for other reasons. And I always feel like it deserves a different level of discussion because it's a topic which people relate to, I think, a little unfairly from one direction or the other. Because either they come at it from a somewhat less than fully respectful attitude, they don't take it seriously enough and treat it like the whole thing is a joke and they don't want to have anything to do with it. And while I recognize, and we'll discuss a little bit more, that there were great Talmidei Chachamim, great Gedolei HaPoskim, who were less than enthusiastic about Mechiras Chametz, certainly acknowledge that, but it does deserve more credit than it gets on the surface, for a lot of reasons, and we'll talk about that. And on the other end of the spectrum, there are those who say, okay, fine, Mechiras Chametz, that's wonderful, but that also just shows that you can get around anything you want in the Torah, you can change anything that you feel like, and why can't you just apply that to everything else? I think neither perspective really does justice to the nuances of what's being discussed, so I'd like to at least make that clear. What are the key elements of how Mechiras Chametz works, and what differentiates it from other things? You can start with a common joke, which maybe illustrates this issue. Been commented that the rabbis decided that smoking is prohibited, but the Orthodox Jews aren't worried if they're just going to sell their lungs to a non-Jew. So for the record, that doesn't work. But you could ask, why doesn't it work? We have a couple of cases, a couple of areas of halacha where sales into non-Jewish hands apparently are utilized. And where do we draw the line? Where is it that here it works, here it doesn't work? What's the difference? So that, right off the bat, is something that we're going to try to have a sensitivity to. That an extension of the point I was saying a second ago is that Mechiras Chametz is sometimes kind of thrown into a bag where you say, okay, not just the Chametz in a bag, but the concept is put into a bag where we say, all right, there are these certain mechanisms that exist in halacha that allow you to get around whatever you want, that allow you to avoid whatever halachas are inconvenient, and they're all just examples of maybe the rabbis utilizing whatever tools they want to, and it's just a list like that. And the first thing we have to appreciate is just because Hatzah HaShava Shebineihem is that they all sometimes reverse an attitude or change an attitude that one might have towards any given halachic principle, they're not really comparable other than that. And it's important to understand what the differences are in order to have an intelligent discussion about it. So if for no other reason that's important, just to make sure that we are discussing a topic accurately to understand what is going on in one case and what is going on in another case. So it's already not really reflective of anything just to say, okay, all of these concepts, they share in common that they are all, for lack of a better word, a tool or a device to end up taking a different approach to some halachic issue, therefore they're all comparable. It's already not so helpful just in terms of accuracy. But what do you find sometimes thrown into this bag? So what other devices, let's say, halacha is probably a better word than that to use, but what other halachic concepts do you find thrown onto this list? Yes? Okay, Prusbul is a big one. All right, what else? That's a Mechir is another big one. We'll contrast maybe those two, Davkit, a second. What else? That's totally in a whole different category. But okay, yeah, I mean, theoretically, yes, that's an interesting example. Not the one that comes to mind more often, but yeah.
Sort of on the same line, like Ribis.
So Heteriska, that's definitely comparable if we're working off that list. Heteriska is what it's called. Sorry, Afkas Kedusha, okay, so that's a whole other discussion. I guess we should have something Kedusha related. What else? Well, depending on how far back you want to go, maybe A-roof. Yeah. Anything else? Chiddush HaSmicha. Okay, so that's, you don't find that utilized there, although maybe you do. Okay, I mean, and that's definitely has its own conversation that's worth having too. So all of these might be invoked as examples of part of this magic toolbox that the rabbis allegedly have, but there's many, many differences between them. So just the first two that were mentioned, are Pruzbul and Heta Mechira, so those are very often invoked in this category. So one major difference between those two, just to illustrate how difficult it is to have a conversation that's too general about this, is that Heta Mechira and Pruzbul almost represent opposite ends just in terms of their range of acceptedness. Because Pruzbul goes back to the time of the Mishnah. Pruzbul is a very old, ancient device, and is clearly accepted by all of Klal Yisrael because it's an institution of Hillel and maybe even predates Hillel. So it's something which is very solidly a part of Halacha according to everyone. And the Heta Mechira, which is a fascinating topic in itself, and if we had weeks to talk about these things, the Heta Mechira should deserve its own few hours of dedicated attention. The Heta Mechira, which is the way it's used nowadays, about 140 years old, 135, 140 years old, dates back to the late 1800s, a plan to sell parts of the land of Israel in order to allow those areas to be worked during the Shemitah year. That's very, very different in terms of its level of acceptedness. And the Heta Mechira is intensely controversial. Phenomenally a source of fighting. There's a lot of reasons for that. Let's see some of the overlapping ones we'll mention. So just if you want to try to make a conversation about this, you want to try to have a discussion, so you put Pruzbul and Heta Mechira in the same category, but many, many people accept Pruzbul but don't accept Heta Mechira. So trying to analyze it already becomes complicated. And Mechiras Chametz, just for purposes of perspective as far as that's concerned, so Mechiras Chametz is somewhere in between. It's much more widely accepted than Heta Mechira, but much less rooted in absolute unanimous acceptance than Pruzbul. So that already just complicates things, because we try to say, oh, the rabbis have a certain attitude. Well, which rabbis are you talking about? So some will be more accepting of one of these examples and less accepting of another. So it's already something that has to be established. But what's also very important is just to appreciate that the details and the nuances in these different categories are sometimes very far apart from each other. So to illustrate that, let's focus on Mechiras Chametz and Heta Mechira for a second. Right, they're both sale devices, so that already connects them a little bit. But there are still major differences. So just for the purposes of illustration, and I want to emphasize, I'm not taking a side in the Heta Mechira debate right now, I'm just using it for the sake of illustration. The Heta Mechira is intensely, intensely controversial, and you have great gedolim on both sides of the debate from the very beginning, Ad Yom HaZeh. But there are a number of very strong differences between the two. So what differences could you think of? So the way I see it, there are at least six differences that are noted between Heta Mechira, again, Heta Mechira without saying anymore, is the Heta Mechira of Shemitah. That's usually the usage. So the Heta Mechira of Shemitah and Mechiras Chametz, I can think of at least six differences between the two, four of which favor Mechiras Chametz, make Mechiras Chametz more acceptable than the Heta Mechira, and two of which favor the Heta Mechira. Again, I should acknowledge there were great gedolim who did feel they were comparable. There were those who wrote that they are essentially put into the same category, but there are many, many nuances between them. So what might be some differences, Morty? Okay, so that's one difference on the surface that seems to favor the Heta Mechira. Right? The Heta Mechira should be more acceptable than Mechiras Chametz, because it seems like that's true, although we'll have to discuss this in more detail, but it certainly seems like that's true, that the Heta Mechira regarding Shemitah is completely contingent on the assumption that Shemitah nowadays is Rabbanan. That's according to everyone. Anyone who is a proponent of the Hetzer Mechira is basing it on the assumption that Shemitah nowadays is not, in effect, Min HaTorah. And for many, many reasons, if we were focusing on that topic, I'd explain in much more greater detail why that's true, but that's a necessary detail of that whole plan. While Mechiras Chametz, on the surface, appears to be dealing with Dinim and HaTorah. Bayra, Bay Matzah is a Torah prohibition. So it sounds like Mechiras Chametz is a Dinim and HaTorah. So one, if one does compare the two, then we could say, all right, Kal v'chomer. So then Het Mechira should be even more accepted than Mechiras Chametz. Although in practice it tends not to be the case. Again, if you want to make a graph, who accepts what? So just speaking broadly, Mechiras Chametz is much more accepted than the Hetzer Mechira. But if that was the only detail we were looking at, you might come to that conclusion. I once did find, I had spent a lot of time trying to nail down exactly what Rav Soloveitchik's opinion was about the Hetzer Mechira. And it's not so easy. It's interesting. There was not as much to work on, to work with, as we might have expected. I had a phone call with Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichrono Lebracha, about this, trying to really get some kind of clarity on the position. It wasn't really clear what he held, but I did see one reference on the internet, which just isn't necessarily in agreement with other references, but it claimed that Rav Soloveitchik had said to someone who was about to go to Eretz Yisrael in the 70s, and the question came up, should they rely on the Hetzer Mechira? And said that the Soloveitchik said to them, well, do you sell your chametz? And he said, yes. He said, okay, so then if you rely on it for a din min haTorah, you should rely on it for a din midrabban. So again, there are other statements of the Rav, I'm not sure if it matches up with, but if that's the metric that you're looking at, okay, so then Hetzer Mechira is stronger than Mechira's chametz. Yes?
The Chiras Chametz might be easier to argue for just because you're definitely not over anything, or at least you're not benefiting or eating the Chametz while during Pesach as opposed to Shemitah, where you're still benefiting from the land, it's just being sold to someone during that year.
Okay, thank you. So that's huge. I think that's a very big factor. That among the objections to the Hetzer Mechira is the question of how serious is the sale. And this is a little bit of a sliding scale kind of question, but how genuine is what's happening? So one could point out that that's a pretty big difference, that when it comes to Mechiras Chametz, so let's assume we're talking to Balabatim here, we're not talking to people who are doing business with Chametz constantly. The question of, let's say, a supermarket that's open over the course of Pesach, that's a whole different discussion in how they deal with Mechiras Chametz. Let's leave that out of this discussion. But speaking to the average layperson who's not in the business of selling Chametz during Pesach, the average user of Chametz or owner of a store that's closed over Pesach, such people are not interacting with their Chametz at all during Pesach. While the Hetzer Mechira, it's very much the opposite, that the whole point of selling the land is so that the land can be worked over the course of Pesach to the benefit of the person who sold it. So there's a much greater continuing involvement for the Hetzer Mechira than there is for Mechiras Chametz. That's a very significant difference which favors Mechiras Chametz. So now we have one point in favor of Mechiras, a clash between the two, which one should be less problematic. We have one point for Mechiras Chametz and one point for Hetzer Mechira. So?
Well, I guess also the opposite. This might be more of a practical versus actually a halacha, but by Mechiras Chametz, the goy really doesn't do anything or he doesn't really acquire the chametz, meaning it's never in his possession. Shemitah, for Hetzer Mechira, I don't know exactly how it works, but it seems to be that he does sort of get
I'm not sure if that's a real difference. We'll have to see. There are those who will question just how much the transfer is actually happening in the Mechiras Chametz, but I don't know if it's going to come down to a difference between the two. So let's set that one aside for a moment and see first how it plays out in the Chametz context to see if it's really different. Jonah?
A little bit more of a technical distinction about the ability to sell
carcass there is a straw, which is the ability to sell the top one to go out.
Okay, so that's technical, but it's huge, right? So that's that by itself could answer the whole question, right? If the question is, why are there so many who accept Mechiras Chametz but don't accept Het Mechira? So that's something that can't be ignored, that a big part of why Het Mechira is so controversial is because of an element that's not relevant to Mechiras Chametz. It's the prohibition of Lo Sechanim, and it seems like there's a prohibition in HaTorah to sell parts of Israel out of Jewish hands. So that's a major, major driver of why the Het Mechira is so controversial. Many who argue against the Het Mechira focus on that more than anything else. So if you remove that from the equation, you take away a good chunk of the machlokas. So yes, that cannot be ignored as a big difference between the two. So if you want to ask, oh, how come you're okay with this and not with that, that certainly is very relevant. Okay, so how many points do we have so far? So 2 points in favor of Mechiras Chametz, that the Lo Sechanim factor, and the lack of involvement. And on the other hand, one argument in favor of the Het Mechira, the Daraisa Darabanan distinction. Any other distinctions you want to throw in? All right, so I'll mention a few more. So on the favor of Mechiras Chametz first, so let's mention 2 points. So one major point is in terms of the seriousness of the sale, another type of objection that was raised, is that when it comes to Mechiras Chametz, so we're generally motivated, it seems, by economic concerns. Don't want to lose all the money we spent on the Chametz. So what would happen if, after Pesach, the purchaser were to say, you know what, I'm interested in keeping the Chametz. I'm not going to give it back to you. Now, a little known detail, which sometimes is not fully appreciated, is that if that were to happen, he would have a big bill to pay. Right? He has to pay for all the chametz that he is going to hold on to. But let's say he would do that. So if he's going to come to you, let's just say you as an individual, you sold your chametz to this non-Jewish person, and he says to you, I'm interested in keeping it, and I'll write you out a check covering the value of all of this chametz. So presumably he'd say, all right, fine. You know, you didn't care so much, you didn't want to lose all that money, but if someone's going to cover the costs, you'll probably take it, all right, no big deal. While when it comes to Eretz Yisrael, I hope that the answer would be very different. If after the Shemitah year, the Arab purchaser comes and says, okay, I've got a check for $100 billion here from the Bank of Saudi Arabia, we're going to hold on now to the land of Israel, or to whatever chunk of it we purchased, so presumably we'd say, no thank you, we're not interested in actually letting you keep it forever. So some point to that as a major difference of the seriousness of the sale, that with Mechiras Chametz we really would theoretically be ready to let it stay away forever. And when it comes to the land of Israel, that's not the case. So that gives us 3 points in favor of Mechiras Chametz. The fourth one is very, very crucial. And this is, again, a point that I think does not get enough attention. So let's take a minute to explain this point. One of the major objections to all of the things that we said before are in that grab bag of different quote-unquote devices, and that gets a little bit of a cynical attitude, is the concept of a harama. What is a harama? How would you translate harama? What did you say?
Tricking.
Tricking? Well, okay, that's definitely taking a certain attitude towards it. Literally, I mean, maybe that's in some context that would be... Also, it depends also, it sounds like the word mirma, which is a trickery, but there is another way to translate it as something like cheating. But harama literally is an evasion. It's a way to get around something. So that word in halacha, harama, ma'arim, you sometimes find in the Gemara, that word is sometimes judgmental. Sometimes, oh, it's a harama, it's an evasion, and you should feel bad about that. And sometimes it's used in a more judgment-neutral way. Basically to say that, okay, technically if you take this step, you will not encounter this halachic objection. And so it's not always used in such a critical way. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. So a harama, sometimes it's something that we feel bad about. Oh, how could you do that? That's just a harama. So the objection to either one of these as a harama is a major, major difference between the two. And this is really something which is so crucial to the discussion and very rarely is acknowledged, and really would be helpful early on to focus on this. If you were to look at het mechira, mechiras chametz, as a way of getting around the din, there's a humongous difference between the two. Anyone know what I'm getting at? In the case of Shemitah, the Harama objection is very strong because the Torah, whether you want to say nowadays it's rabbinic law or Torah law, but the original din of the Torah is that you should not work your land during Shemitah. And the purpose of the sale is to let you work the land during Shemitah. It's to do the opposite of what the din is. Is that the same thing when it comes to Mechiras Chametz? It's very much not. If the Torah says you're not allowed to own Chametz on Pesach, and what are you trying to do by selling the Chametz? It's a different way of not owning it. You would assume that getting rid of your Chametz means destroying it completely. And Mechiras Chametz means you don't destroy it completely, you shift its ownership for a while. Now, is that sufficient for what the Torah is asking? Okay, that's the big machlokes. That, there's a lot to argue about. But it's not the opposite of what the Torah is telling you to do. It just may or may not be enough to accomplish what the Torah is asking. You follow the difference? I think that's a humongous difference. The question is not, are we completely escaping what the Torah is asking for? The question is this enough? Because, as we'll try to discuss, the assumption that, oh, the Torah clearly wants us to never see the Chametz again, I don't know if that's clear from the text. We'll have to see if that's necessarily so obviously the Ratzon HaTorah. All we know from the Torah is we should get rid of our chametz and not own chametz over Pesach. So maybe this is a sufficient way of doing that. So that's something we'll have to figure out. So from the perspective of a harama, there's a big difference between the two. Big enough? Debatable. But a big difference. Now, while we're mentioning harama, the point in favor of Mechiras Karkos that you're dealing with Rabbanan is a major, major nekuda, because part of the general harama discussion, or do we like haramas, do not like haramas, if you were to assume that they were comparable, so then the detail of Daraisa the Rabbanan is very significant, because there are many who will say, if you want to put them all on the same spectrum, that haramas I can live with if it's a din the Rabbanan. But it didn't in the Torah, I'm not comfortable with haramas. And just to take a minute to explain why that is, it's not just a question of severity, but there's more of a absolute distinction between the two. And this is itself a whole discussion, I'm only just trying to summarize it in a sentence, that essentially what a harama means is you're following the letter of the law, but we're uncomfortable with how close it is to the spirit of the law. Right, that's basically what bothers us about a harama. But okay, so maybe technically you're all right. You found a way to not be filed, not be troubled by the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law is not satisfied. So if that's how you understand a harama, so then there could be a major fundamental difference between daraisas and drabanans, and it's not just a matter of degree. That daraisas were worried about the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. But by Dinim D'Rabbanan, this is part of a whole different discussion, but by Dinim D'Rabbanan, you could argue there is no such thing as the spirit of the law. That our adherence to Dinim D'Rabbanan is a matter of showing deference to the rabbis to not rebel against their legislation. And their legislation is mostly protective in nature, basically to create a buffer zone, usually between you and a Torah violation. So it could be argued there is no spirit of the law. As long as you're in compliance with the letter of the law, you have fully addressed the purpose and the reality of a din d'rabbanan. So therefore, you could say they're completely different, that when it comes to a rabbinic law, a harama is totally okay because it means I'm in compliance with the rabbinic directive, and that's all we need to do, and that makes you fully 100% a wonderful Jew in all ways. While with Torah law, it's not necessarily true. There's both the letter and the spirit, and if you're not fulfilling the spirit, you're going to be more concerned. So within the whole harama discussion, if you could generalize it, then the derisive rabbanan factor is going to be significant. Okay, so far so good. Everything makes sense? Yeah, everyone following? Okay, so far we've said, and four arguments, some of which I think are very significant, that favor Mechiras Chametz, and one that favors Het Mechira. So we'll just mention one more before getting into the details. This one I heard in the name of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. It's one that you can note on your own, but it's a question of position taken by on the Chacham. So this is, I heard this name of Aaron Soloveitchik, that he was asked about the Het Mechira, and he said whether it's appropriate or not, it all boils down to one question. How necessary is it? How important is it for the viability of Klal Yisrael that it happens? Because this is one of the major controversial points within the Het Mechira. Right? The Het Mechira, we said before, it's humongously controversial, and unfortunately it's kind of a perpetual motion machine for machlokas, because it was intensely controversial when it was first proposed in the 1880s, and it hasn't changed as far as level of heat, as far as degree of controversy. It continues to be just as controversial today, and every 7 years it kind of renews itself, because every time it comes up again, the next Shemitah cycle, not only is the old fight still going on, but there's all kinds of reasons to add new levels to the fight. And each side says, well, things changed in the past 7 years in a way that even if you felt one way last time, now you should for sure agree with me. And they'll say that on both sides of the equation. Because a big part of the discussion in the Het Mechira is, okay, we all know that ideally we would like to have an environment where Shemitah is observed in the fullest sense of the word. So the question is, but circumstances don't allow for it? How true is that? How true is it that circumstances don't allow for it? So when the Het Mechira was first proposed, it was relevant to a few Moshavim in the pre-state land of Israel, which really were isolated and very, very dire circumstances economically, and you could say, alright, listen, this is mamish karuv pikuach nefesh for these people. But now we have a state, and increasingly a flourishing state, and a global economy, and it's not so necessary anymore. That's one track that conversation could take. Others could say the same thing the opposite way. You know, then, in the 1800s, there was no entire Medina that was at stake. Now you have a whole country whose economy could be affected in such profound ways, you need it more. So again, it's a very subjective discussion. But a lot of it will revolve around simply the circumstances. So how do we assess what's going on in the rest of the context here, and whether this is a necessary and appropriate one? So from that perspective, if we're looking at things just through that question, so then you could say, all right, listen, Het Mechira, I understand. This is a real necessity for society. But Mechiras Chametz, okay, so you'll throw out those boxes of cereal. Okay, so you'll pour those schnapps down the drain. Is that really such a big deal? You're not going to starve. So that's what, if that's the element that you're focused on, then that maybe favors Het Mechira. Okay, we understand why this is necessary. And Mechiras Chametz, many object to, because come on, why is it so crucial? Maybe once upon a time, or for certain individuals, it still really affects their overall parnasa. But again, the average Balabas, who's getting rid of a few items of chametz, is it so crucial that he hold on to it through this method of mechiras chametz? Maybe not. So those are some of the distinctions which help to frame the whole discussion. So with that lengthy introduction, so now let's focus on mechiras chametz itself. So what's the basis for mechiras chametz? Is it something that we find in Chazal? So hopefully you got a chance to see a little bit on the Makaros, that the answer is yes and no. Right? That there are some statements that we can put together from Gemara's, Mishnayos, and Tosefta's especially, but there's still a difference between that and what we have today, and that's why it's still something to argue about. So I think we mentioned in Parshas here a few weeks ago, the concept of Mechiras Bechor, right? That came up on a Thursday one day. So there, it's a good example of overlapping ideas, but also differences. The Gemara mentions, the Gemara has in the very beginning of Mesechta Becharos, that Bechor is a tricky situation nowadays. Because let's say you have an animal that's about to give birth to a Bechor. So you're going to be in trouble, because what do you do with a Bechor nowadays? Right, it's going to have the Kedushas Bechor, but you can't carry out the halachos of Kedushas Bechor. We don't have all the necessary elements in place. So you're going to be stuck. It's going to be a very, very undesirable situation halachically. So therefore, the Gemara recommends that you avoid the situation of Kedushas Bechor, and maybe you'll call this a harama, that since an animal, that if the mother animal is owned in partnership, not only by a Jew, but a Jew and a non-Jew together, so there's an exemption from Kedushas Bechor. So if you have an animal that's about to give birth to a Bechor, so what you should do is you should sell it partially to a non-Jew, and that way it's not going to be subject to the halachos of Bechor. So there we have this advised as a strategy. But the major difference from other things that we're discussing here is that it really has a much greater need, because what are you going to do otherwise? You're going to be stuck. Right? You don't have a good way to resolve this without avoiding the situation. So that's more of a neutral, or even more than that, usage of harama. Yeah, you better be ma'arim, you better avoid the situation, because we can't really deal with it if you get in that situation. So there, as far as need is concerned, so the need is much more understandable. But theoretically, this is an example of availing yourself of mechira in order to address a halachic challenge. But it doesn't necessarily help us from mechiras chametz, because it's not clear that we have the same degree of hechra here. You could deal with the chametz situation. But theoretically, there is some precedent here. And nowadays, since both are carried out, both these types of mechira, so we nowadays, we tend to see mechiras chametz, and how often do we see mechiras bechor? But if you're on a farm, you might see it more often. It does happen nowadays. It is something that is practiced. And as far as how it's done, there's a lot in common with mechiras chametz. But it has that difference as far as whether it's equally necessary. So that's one possible precedent. Now when it comes to chametz specifically, the Mishnah in Pesachim does talk about mechira as a method of tashbisu. So, okay, well, there you have it. Mishnah says that you can fulfill tashbisu with selling your chametz. Well, the difference is, what the Mishnah is talking about, is selling it in a full, complete sense. That you have an item, and you sell it to someone else, and you don't plan on ever seeing it again. And as far as you're aware of, it's taken away from you, never to be heard from again. So maybe you could say, all right, that's one thing. And even that happens to be in machlokas in the Mishnah, because Beis Shammai had a chumrah. Beis Shammai felt that you have to sell it in a way that it's at least likely or feasible that it will be consumed before Pesach. But to sell it in such a way that it's unlikely that it's going to be consumed and it's still going to be out there in the world, even though you sold it. Because Shammai was mashmah the day, even that's not good enough. But we assume, like Beis Hillel, that you're not responsible for what happens to it after you sell it. So that, as a method of Teshbisu, okay. But there again, you're saying goodbye to it forever. So that is not what troubles most of the detractors of Mechiras Chametz. When there's an objection to Mechiras Chametz, it's because you're going to get it back afterwards, and you perhaps have it in your house during the course of Pesach. Those differences are what draw all the fire, so it's not comparable to the Mechiras Chametz that's discussed in the Mishnah. Now there's a Tosefta, which is much more comparable, but still maybe falls short of what we have today. What does the Tosefta say? So this you probably saw, I read a lot of the Rishonim quote this. Let's say you're on a boat. So especially in those days, if you traveled by boat, so schedules were much less predictable than they are nowadays. Nowadays, we know things aren't always so predictable, but we usually have some sense of when our conveyances are leaving and coming back and how our trip's going to unfold. But it's easily imaginable back then, especially you're on a boat, and you don't really know exactly when you're going to get where you need to get. So let's imagine you're on a boat, and you have chametz in your possession. Maybe it's not some chocolate bar or some cake, but it's chametz that's a part of your parnassah. It's a significant element of what you need to live. And you find that, oh, Pesach is coming and the boat hasn't got there yet. So you're still going to be on the ship over the course of Pesach. So what are you going to do? You can't just throw it over the boat because this is something that you can't afford to lose. So the Tosefta says that, yes, you can enter into an arrangement with one of the non-Jewish fellow travelers on the boat. If you're on one of these old Jewish boats, then you're in trouble. But assuming that you're on a boat that has non-Jewish passengers too, so then you can work out something with him that he takes ownership during Pesach, and you'll get it back after Pesach. Okay, so that's clearly the closest to what we have nowadays. So if that's what it says in the Tosefta, that you can do that, so why is it controversial nowadays? So is there a difference between what the Tosefta describes and what we do? Morty?
That keeps all seems to be a lot more need over
there. A lot more what, sorry?
That keeps all seems to be a greater need over there.
Okay, right. So there, first of all, the Tzorech seems greater. Let's say we could assume it's not like Bechor, where you just, even if you're a completely selfless tzaddik who doesn't care about money, but you're going to be put in a unworkable halachic position, so Bechor was even more so. But here, okay, maybe this is more parnassa driven, but parnassa is crucial, and you can't live without a parnassa, that's not what the word means. So, alright, maybe there's a real tzorech for it. Maybe there's that difference. What else? There's a few other differences also. At least two other significant differences in assessing it. Well, one difference is that this boat is not your house, right? So the chametz is not going to stay in your house over the course of Pesach the way it tends to nowadays. That, to some, is a very big detail. And also, as far as a little bit of a subjective element, but one that also get some attention, is that it sounds like what we described here is that this was unforeseen mistake. And basically, you didn't plan on doing this, but you found yourself stuck with a situation where you can't afford to get rid of the chametz that you have, and you didn't expect to be on this boat with this chametz on Pesach time. So okay, so fine, this is how you should deal with it this time. But nowadays, what we do is very, very different. Right? What we do is we have put in our shul schedules months in advance that, oh, when you want to sell your chametz, here are the times when everyone's going to be on a long line to do it, and the whole community is doing it at the same time, and we plan our shopping knowing that we'll be able to sell the chametz when the time comes, and it's something that we do every year. So maybe that's very different from what's described here in this Tosefta. So that's actually a topic that the Rishonim addressed. If you had a chance to see the Rishonim here. But the Rishonim say that, yeah, this trip, so to speak, in the Tosefta works, but Ubilvad Shalo Yarin. And it's crucial, if you're going to do this, that it not be a harama. So the Beis Yosef, of course, this asks, what do you mean, Ubilvad Shalo Yarin? The whole thing is a harama. Right? This whole thing is a way of getting around it, and that's what we're telling you, here's how you do it. So what do you mean? You can do this as long as it's not harama. By its very nature, it's a harama. So what does it mean, it shouldn't be a harama? So in the Rishonim, there are different interpretations of what that means. Some of which are a problem for us, some of which are less of a problem for us, and some of which may be somewhere in between. So what kind of interpretations do you find in the Rishonim of what that sentence means? Yes, Jed?
The Ritva?
Yes, who says what?
He says it shouldn't be a beer, some probate,
you know, uh-oh, right? So that's not so good for us. Right, so if that's what it means, that you can't do this regularly, so that's a very bad interpretation for us. So indeed, if that's really what it means, so then we're in trouble, because we do this every year. So that's one that is a problem for us. What other interpretations do you find? So, yeah?
And just adding to Matana Gemura.
Oh, okay. So that's something which we actually discussed in Kedushin some time ago, a few months ago. Right, that there is a kpeda, the Rishonim mentioned, that it should not be a matana manas lahatzir. So matana manas lahatzir, if you say, okay, I'm giving this to you, on the condition that you give it back to me, then that is a problem. Now, if you recall, we discussed the sugya of matana manas lahatzir this year, why this is good synergy material. So we discussed then that actually it's not so clear why that should be a problem. And this is something that's it's a good opportunity for a little chazara slash synergy to ponder this for a second. Right? That when we talked about the sugya of matana manas lahatzir, the truth is this should be a pretty good example of where matana manas lahatzir should work. Right? Because first of all, we say that matana manas lahatzir Shmei Matana, right? That a gift, even if it's on condition that be returned to you, has the halachic status of a gift. It is the possession of the recipient during the time that he has it. So you can make a good case that al pi din, why not? So he owns it during that time. And this is better than some other cases, right? Some of the cases the Gemara talks about Matana Manasa Hatsir, so we discussed at the time, when it makes a little more sense and when it's a little harder to understand. And we assume that, let's say, if it's about paying somebody something that is owed. So that's where Matana Manasa Hafsir makes the least sense. How could it work to pay your bills to the electric company and say, okay, I'm paying you this money, but it's Manasa Hafsir, you got to give it back to me next month. So no one's going to do that. So clearly when there's a real debt, so Matana Manasa Hafsir shouldn't work. But if it's more about, let's say, some kind of technicality, that you have to give something over, then it could work. So here you can say, listen, you're not supposed to own the chametz on Pesach, so during the duration of Pesach it'll be his. And after Pesach it'll come back to you. What's so terrible? And if you recall, we discussed that, the question of how do you understand why this should be a problem, but this is something that the later Svarim struggled with, that maybe Alpi Din should work. So, without rehashing all those details, so there were those who felt that, yeah, you're right, Al Pi Din, it should work, but maybe that's already too much for us in the Harama department. That if it's so explicit that it's going to come back to you and that's a part of the initial deal, so then that's just too much for us. Then we really feel like we're not being serious here. So maybe that's part of the concern. That it's not really that it doesn't work, it's that that's not something we're comfortable bringing into our attitude towards chametz. Or we mentioned the possibility that why maybe it doesn't work in a more fundamental way, that maybe it threatens to retroactively undo the deal in the first place. And I mentioned the Rabbis and others, maybe that's the story. So this is a good opportunity just to explain what really does happen, by the way. So what does happen and we sell chametz in terms of the amanas, the hafzir component. So, and this is also something which could be misunderstood, and the consequences of misunderstanding it could be very significant. So let's explain this for a minute. That the chametz is not sold with any kind of matan amanas, the hafzir, or Pesach. There is no condition that it has to come back after Pesach. That is crucial, or at least it's important to know that it's not made contingent on that before Pesach. But also, significantly, and this is something that some people don't understand, it's not contingent on anything. So that is a very important detail to understand. So again, here's some major synergy material here. So we spent a lot of time at the beginning of the year and many times afterwards talking about the nature of Kenyan Kesef, right? How exactly that transaction works. So it's very important when it comes to Mechiras Chametz. That whole question, right, who are our best friends in that discussion? I think the Taz and the Sma, I can't forget about them. And the question of how Kenyan Kesef works. So it's very important, very, very crucial detail, it's almost more important than anything else, to know how this works in the context of Mechiras Chametz. When we sell the chametz, the purchaser does a number of kinyanim. I guess this topic will probably spill over at least tomorrow. I don't want to spend the whole week on it, but at least we'll have to continue this topic a little bit tomorrow. So, but just to say a few minutes now, that the purchaser does a number of kinyanim. We do 6 or 7 kinyanim. It's really very instructive to watch if you have the opportunity. You want to learn more about kinyanim, so Erev Pesach, it's a good thing to experience. So we do a number of different kinyanim in order to affect this transaction. It's a whole discussion why, maybe we'll spend more time on that. But the Kenyan Kesef, so how does that play in here? So the purchaser does not give over the whole value of the chametz. Not even close. He gives a very, very small percentage of what the chametz is worth. At that time, Erev Pesach, he gives over a very, very small amount of money. So, it's basically a shavapruta per seller. So that's nothing compared to the actual value of the chametz. Now, after Pesach, if he wants to keep the chametz, like we said before, he will have to pay the rest of the value. He'll have to finish off this payment. And what tends to happen is that he does not. And the chametz after Pesach ends up back in the possession of the original seller. But what are the mechanics there? This is crucial. Right? Do we say that, oh, the sale was contingent on him paying the whole price? Now that he's telling us he doesn't want to pay the whole price, so he has to give it back. That would be a disastrous understanding. Why? Because that would mean the sale was never good. So then your whole plan here would be completely undermined. Because it'll turn out retroactively that he never owned the chametz. It was all contingent on him paying for it, and he didn't pay for it. So if that's how you understand what's happening, then we're in trouble. The whole thing never worked. So instead, what's really happening? When he makes the Kenyan Kesef, the chametz becomes his absolutely, with no strings or conditions or any other qualifications. That is a Kenyan, as we know, especially we have favored the opinion, presumably throughout the year, certainly in the context of Kedushin, but probably with all Kenyanim, that Kenyan Kesef is symbolic, it's not really towards the purchase price. So this is an absolute transaction. The kesef that he puts forward, he fully acquires the chametz for all intents and purposes. But he now has a debt. He has a debt of the purchase price. So now, if he comes and he says, listen, I can't pay the debt, I can't afford to give you all the money that the chametz actually is worth, so then we'll say, okay, so what are we going to do here? You owe us all this money, and you're not ready to pay it. So then we could say, well, will accept the chametz back instead. But that is a new transferal. It's not that the chametz never got sold because it wasn't paid for. The chametz was sold. And instead of getting the payment, we'll take the chametz back. And mashul mahadavar doma, I think this is how it works in this context as well. So let's say you buy a couch from the store, from the furniture store, and you pay in down payments. And then you can't make the payments, so the store comes and repossesses the couch. So what happened there? Is it that you never actually owned the couch because you didn't make all the payments? I don't think so. I think what happened was, and I'll be din, I'm more sure, but I'm saying even just in secular law, what happened there? So you owned the couch from the very beginning. They gave you the couch, and it's yours. And you have a debt to pay for the couch. And if it turns out that you can't cover the debt, you can't pay the rest, so then a mechanism that's available to the creditor, to the store in this case, is okay, they can't get the payment, they can take the couch instead, and that should cover their lack of payment. But it's not that the couch was never yours. It was yours when you bought it, and the store just has a right to take it back instead of getting paid. So too here, the chametz was always the purchaser's, and just if he can't pay for it, so then instead of payment, he'll give it back. So,
does that mean you can find a guy who has the capabilities of paying in the end for all the chametz?
Then, right, then, the rest of the sentence, then you...
No, I'm saying if you can't find that guy, then shouldn't be a mega house of some sort?
Oh, you said you should find one who can.
Yes.
So the truth is, yeah, so I just mentioned this. So this is an interesting detail. So Yisrael's point is well taken. So I sell my chametz in Riverdale when I was Pesach, which Rabbi Willig, together with probably an increasing number, say probably 40 other rabbis from the New York area, go to Rabbi Willig's shul on Erev Pesach to sell the chametz. It's a fascinating experience. It's been covered by the New York Times and other outlets. And Rabbi Willig has, she doesn't do well, a purchaser he's been using for, I think, more than 30 years. And he certainly prefers this purchaser. I only learned recently just to what degree. I think he actually does see this as a matter of a crucial halakhic detail. Purchaser, his name is Mr. Brown, really, John J. Brown is his actual name. He is a real estate businessman, and there's a number of reasons why that's helpful here. So first of all, he understands kinyanim. He understands transactions and what the law exactly is saying when something is transferred. So that helps for the seriousness here, that he really has a very strong grasp of what exactly is going on and what he is entering into. But also, crucially, that should he decide that he wants to hold on to all the chametz, he would have a way of putting together the money, or at least a certain significant degree. He has a business context where he could pull it off, or pull it off at least enough that he could decide, okay, there's a good chunk of this chametz I want to hold on to, and I could do that. So that, as you're implying, helps a lot in terms of the seriousness of what's going on. And maybe even Likuva, I think that's how Willig actually understands it, which wasn't so obvious all the time, but that, you know, that that's really necessary, that you should be selling to somebody. I think in the Amordechai on Moed, he discusses this, that to have a purchaser who actually is capable of paying for it is a crucial detail, and that's a big problem for the whole rest of the world, because most people sell the chametz to people who don't necessarily have the wherewithal to actually get a hold of the funds to pay for all the chametz. So if that detail really is mamish ma'akev, then that's a problem. But certainly, at least the hiddur, it certainly contributes to the seriousness of what's going on. So that's essentially your question. How ma'akev is it? So it's a big part of it. Okay, so I think we're going to run out of time. So let's just recap what we spoke about. So I guess tomorrow we'll say a little bit more, but then after that we should go back to Kiddushin. But just to recap what we discussed, so we talked about having an open mind towards the different areas of halacha where we find approaches that seem to allow us to go in a different way from what would apparently be the halachic requirement, how they shouldn't all be grouped together in either direction, either to avoid them all equally or to say that they show that you can do whatever you want. And we especially focused on comparing two of the mechira devices, mechira schanet and the hetz mechira, and we noted that there are major differences, even though there are some great gedolim who compared them, not to deny that, but there are six differences that we discussed between the two. Four that favor mechira schanet, and that you don't have the issue of lo sechanim that applies to the hetz mechira, you're not involved with the chametz during the time that it's out of your ownership, and it's not the opposite of what the Torah is asking for. Those are pretty significant differences. And the fourth one also, that you'd be willing, like you just discussed, to let it go after Pesach if they covered the cost, and presumably not when it comes to the Hetz Mechira. But two differences that go in the other direction, that maybe, we'll have to discuss this more tomorrow, it's a major detail, that maybe Chametz involves Daraisas and Hetz Mechira involves only the Rabbanans. And also the major question of just how necessary it is, Hetz Mechira, the assumption is that there's necessity driving it, and Mechira Chametz usually doesn't seem so necessary, so that's a major part of the discussion. And then we started getting into what are the Talmudic precedents for Mechira Chametz, and we noted three that have varying degrees of relevance. So the Mechira Bechor is one, but that has major differences just in terms of need, because Bechor, there's no other way to address the situation. And Chametz, maybe that's not true. The Mishnah says Mechira Chametz could work for Teshbisu, but that's talking about absolute Mechira, really selling it to never see it again. And even that was Machlokes Bechorim Beshamay, how that would work. And the Tosefta talks about selling it and getting it back afterwards, but that also had a few differences, closest that we have to what we do today. But there also, it's different in a number of ways. It seems like the need is greater. It seems like it's a b'di'evet, inadvertent situation that only happens once. And also, it's not taking place in your house, not leaving the chametz in your house's territory. And we saw that the Rishonim have a phrase, according to Tosafta, that it's okay as long as there's no harama. The Beis Yosef says, what do you mean? The whole thing's a harama. So we discussed that we actually only got to two of the interpretations. We'll have to discuss the third one tomorrow in terms of how the Rishonim understand this issue of harama. The Ritva understands it as don't do it every year. That's a bad interpretation for us because that gets us in trouble. Other Rishonim understand that it shouldn't be a matana manas lahachzir. We discussed that question. Well, why should it not be matana manas lahachzir? Having learned the sugi of matana manas lahachzir, it seems like actually this is a good candidate for matana manas lahachzir being effective. And we discussed some suggestions. Why not? Maybe it just becomes too much of a harama under those circumstances. And then we discussed the very crucial question of what indeed does happen, how it's not amanas hachzer, but even more importantly, it's not amanas anything. It's not the sale that only kicks in if the money is fully paid out, because if so, that will result in a reversal of the sale, and the whole thing is going to be completely counterproductive. We're not going to have a sale of chametz at all. So it's crucial detail to understand here is that the sale is absolute without any conditions or contingencies, but instead of paying the full value afterwards, there is an option open to the purchaser that he can give it back rather than pay off his debt. But that is not contingent, doesn't reverse the sale retroactively, and that's crucial for this to work. So tomorrow, again, we could easily spend the whole week on Mechira Schametz, at least the main things we want to just get before going back to Kiddushin. We need to talk about what's the other objection in Rishonim to the Harama concern, that we have to see whether it's good for us or not. And also, at least one thing we want to discuss is it true that we're dealing with Daraisas here? Is there some flexibility on that point? And what emerges from that? So let's at least hope to get those major details tomorrow, and then presumably we'll go back to Kiddushin. All right, who wants to daven for us?